I rang my wife at 3:30 in the morning, just before an attack we did in Iraq, saying, I've just ordered my soldiers to their certain death. You have to understand what that means in really sort of visceral terms when you are taking young people and ordering them to do something that you know will kill them. It is too easy to forget the sacrifice that people make. And the sacrifice that people make is almost never for, quote, their country. It's for their mates. It's the ultimate in the sort of bond between somebody and their team. I was genuinely horrified as a very young officer at how poorly my soldiers were treated. And I really wanted to do something about that. Was I successful? I don't know, but I tried.
Lieutenant General Richard Nugie rose to the very top of the armed forces, finishing as Chief of Defence People. Despite multiple operational commands, his passion and purpose was always to improve the lot of his soldiers, and subsequently, everyone working in the Ministry of Defence. Anyone who knows him will tell you he's hugely humble and has kept his feet firmly on the ground. Richard discusses how to change culture and the imperative to adapt your leadership style to suit the environment. As we approach Remembrance Sunday, Richard considers the heavy responsibility of leadership and the importance of taking time to reflect on those who have made the ultimate sacrifice. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Richard.
My grandfather was a professional soldier. He was the only other soldier in the family, a professional soldier in the family. I mean, my father did national service, but as a private soldier in the gunners. My grandfather had had the ambition since the age of 3. He fought the whole way through the First World War. He fought the whole way through the Second World War. He bounced from the First World War to the Third Afghan War. So the only medal we actually have in common is an Afghan medal. And he ended up as CRA Gibraltar in the Second World War and then BRA Southern Command, which was fantastic because he was training people to go to D-Day. He ended up as a full colonel in the records office, in the Manning and Records office. He was a difficult man. He'd been gassed in the First World War. He had a very gruff sense of humour. And so we were frankly just terrified of him. We used to go and see him. We'd spend 10 minutes with him, and then my father would shoo us off into the garden or something, and he would spend time with his father. 3 days before he died, we went to go and see him, my brother and I. My recollection is he spent 3 hours talking about his life in the army, talking about how much he loved his life in the army. He could still name his first troop from 1914. Wow. He talked about his 6 lucky escapes in the First World War when he should have been killed and he wasn't. And then he finished by saying, I don't know who he was saying it to. He might have been saying it to me. He might have been saying it to my father. He said, there is nothing better in the world. There is no greater privilege in your life than commanding soldiers. And that really stuck. It said so much. First of all, he said, soldiers are brilliant people. They're the salt of the earth. They're the best you could possibly imagine in a nation. And then he said, it's a privilege to command them. Went back to school the next day. Notice went up on the notice board saying, all those who want to join the Royal Artillery, please sign up. So I did. Not because I wanted to join the army at all. I was 14 or something. But because I was going to ask him whether he knew my grandfather. Well, the gunners were a million strong at the end of the Second World War. He was one of goodness knows how many brigadiers in the gunners. And this recruiter probably joined the army. I worked out later, obviously all of it later, but was probably joined the army in the 50s. So there's absolutely no chance whatsoever that he would have heard of him. And yet he was a brilliant enough recruiter. And he just turned that innocent question into a really strong desire to join the army. And so I joined the army. I got a scholarship at the age of 16. I was sent to university at the age of 19 on a cadetship and then went back to Sandhurst in 1985. Goodness.
You followed the normal route that young officers take and you commanded your regiment. But then after that, you did an unusual mix of really being a specialist in the people space. Was that a conscious decision of yours or someone else's, or how did that work?
So I'd spent 6 years, 7 or 8 years in the Gunners in the field. I'd done 4 Northern Ireland tours in my first 5 years and I had some pretty hair-raising moments then. And I thought I was a reasonable operational soldier. I don't think I've ever thought I was a particularly good operational soldier, but a reasonable operational soldier, and I had a lot of experience. So I went to Staff College, went and did my maths O-level again and my physics O-level and my chemistry O-level and so on, and really wasn't enjoying it. I was told I was destined to be a what was called SO2 G3 ops, so an operator as a major in the division. And then my job got changed. And it got changed to going to the director of Manning Army. And I was furious, absolutely furious. In fact, I went up to my divisional colonel, who I got on very well with afterwards, and I swore at him and said, who the hell shafted me? You know, I'm going to this ghastly people job. He looked very concerned. He said, Richard, let me find out what's gone on. And what went on was that Commander of Royal Artillery was artillery. The Chief of Staff was Royal Artillery. The SO1 Ops was Royal Artillery. And the last thing they needed was another artillery officer in the operational chain. So they had stopped it and put, somebody from the tank regiment into that job. So it was nothing to do with me. It was the fact that it was my cap badge. They didn't want too much of one cap badge in the chain. And so the commandant had personally selected me to go into this job. And that's what I was told. And I said, this is absolutely ghastly. End of my career. I'm never going to survive this. It's all sort of be a complete nightmare. I did it for nearly 3 years. I was awarded an MBE for it. It turned out to be one of the most rewarding jobs I'd ever done. I was taken kicking and screaming into the Empress State Building, as it was in London. But it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
And then did you consciously specialise into the people space, or was that difficult to do?
I was incredibly lucky. So I did 2 operational tours as a captain, 2 as a lieutenant, 2 as a major, 2 as a lieutenant colonel, and in the end, 1 as a brigadier and 1 as a major general. My main strand should have been operations. But every time I was taken back into the personnel world, because it's actually what I really enjoyed and seemed to be quite good at. When I fired in my first regiment, I really wasn't enjoying it. It was a heavy artillery regiment in Germany. I just thought, you know, what have I joined? And I said to my commanding officer after 2 years, I said, I'm off. I'm going to do my minimum amount and I'm going. He said, I understand you. I hear you. What would it take? What do you want to do that will allow you to stay? And I said, it's very straightforward. I will only stay if I can improve the lot of my soldiers, because they're just really badly treated here. And it wasn't just badly treated by fellow soldiers. It was badly treated by the regiment in terms of what they did. The whole attitude and sort of culture was one of belittling people rather than building people. And that's what I really disliked. You know, what could he do as a commanding officer? But he said, I will give you every opportunity to improve the lot of your soldiers. And so that stayed with me throughout my career, and it became my mantra. I'm only going to do this if I can improve the lot of my soldiers, whatever my soldiers are, whether it's when I'm in command or whether it's in a staff job. It sort of worked that I ended up in the people space.
Can you talk a little bit about how you saw the culture change between when you were operating at the army level and at the MOD level?
Sandhurst does all sorts of things to you in the army. It tries to find a fine line between giving you the confidence as a young officer to do what is right and arrogance. And you see both traits failing in some people. You see some people who become incredibly arrogant. Because they've been through Sandhurst, they are owed a sense of respect, which I fundamentally disagree with. As I say, I come from a non-military family, and I was constantly surprised that anybody would listen to me. Why should they listen to this insignificant person who, just because he's been through Sandhurst, gives him a right to be just accepted without any thought? I said, I wouldn't do that. Why would people do that to me? But you also end up with the people who are, frankly, lacking in confidence, and they tend not to do very well either. So you've got the very arrogant and you've got the lacking in confidence. And it's this balance that Sandhurst tries to create between this. It's a thin line. everybody strays over it one way or the other at times. And I think I was quite an arrogant young man, but was aware that I was doing things wrong and I needed to be much more listening and humble. I had a brilliant experience in Northern Ireland. It was my second tour. I don't know whether you remember the Brighton bombing, which tried to take out Mrs. Thatcher's cabinet. Most of the people who did the Brighton bombing lived in a small village called Greencastle, just north of Omagh. And it had been out of band since the Brighton bombing. And we were the first, quote, green troops to go in. Green as in normal army. So I put a vehicle checkpoint on the road into Greencastle before I went into the village. Lo and behold, somebody of immense intelligence interest came into my VCP and I thought, that's fantastic. And then another one, and then another one, and then another one. And it was getting dark and I could see people circling round on the hill above and coming into the checkpoint to hold me on the road. So I realised what was going on. They were setting up a chute. And so I pulled off the road into the fields and it was dark by then and they searched for us in the field with their cars from the headlights. The second in command of my multiple was a guy called Bombardier Sammy Nichols, and I owe him so much. He ended up as a half colonel. Sammy had spent 8 years in intelligence in Northern Ireland, so massively experienced. And here I was on my second tour in my second year in the army proper. So I said to Sammy, Sammy, what do I do now? And Sammy turned around and said, really simply, he said, you're the boss, you tell us. Sammy knew exactly what he would do, but he didn't push it down my throat. He let me make the decisions. And I said, right, Sammy, we're going to do this, 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 and this. Does that work? And he said, yeah, that works. And we found the shoot site and nothing happened and it was very peaceful and it was great. But there's a piece here about understanding soldiers and understanding the role as an officer. I think there's a culture in the army which verges on arrogant and is easy to verge on arrogant and not listen. What I found as Chief of Defence people up at the three-star level was that doesn't work with the Navy and the Air Force, let alone the civil service. And I was responsible for all the civil service and defence as well as all the Army, Navy and Air Force. And so just being arrogant and demanding rather than listening just doesn't work because it's not the culture of the other two services in the same way. It is a peculiarly army culture. And so what I noticed was that actually the army culture has the ability to damage itself. It also has the ability to be brilliant on the battlefield. And we should not get away. We have a fantastic warfighting culture in the British military. But it doesn't always work in Whitehall, and it doesn't always work with the other services. And that's what we need to really sort of develop, I would have thought. And that's what I saw.
There's a degree of self-awareness that one needs in order to understand that at the personal and at the collective level. But do you think that that can be improved through training, or has it got to be done by having a great mentor and a mentoring relationship with people that are going to educate and inform you in for your blind spots?
I actually think training is of limited value. You can't really train culture, in my view. Those who say, let's change the culture, have absolutely no idea what culture means, in my view. You can change culture, but you have to be very visible leaders, which comes to your mentoring point. And I think that is by far the most important. You learn from watching other people. You learn from being at the other end of other people's decisions and other people's behaviour. You change culture by changing behaviours, and that usually takes incentives. Positive incentives most of the time, but negative incentives work as well. You change culture by changing the organisational structures. And the fourth is you must have a narrative. And so for me, training in itself is not enough, anything like. It's about being those positive role models. And to be a positive role model in terms of culture, you need to be self-aware that actually it might not work and you need to adapt. I used to talk about up-and-atom grenadiers type leadership. You need the ability to lead people in battle when they're frightened, they don't want to do it. And it's not at the point of a gun at their back, it's at the point of actually you're doing something because they understand why they're doing it and they want to follow you. But you need to be able to adapt that leadership, and quite a lot of people can't do this, I would argue. You need to be able to adapt that sort of leadership into actually, I've got a committee and I need to bring the whole committee along with me. Up and Atom Grenadiers type leadership just doesn't work in that circumstance. It's why I personally have a bit of a problem with mission command in a non-mission orientated environment, as most staff jobs are. And so people just saying, well, let's just put mission command into the staff, to my mind, shows a lack of understanding of mission command and also a lack of understanding of what staff need to do and how they need to do it. You need a different style of leadership to make that work.
The ability to adapt your leadership style to the environment you're in ought to be a key measure of success. But do you think that the emphasis about operational style leadership and its link to promotion generates a risk that people will be selective about applying one leadership style in order to progress?
There's a risk, yes. But we should be under no illusion. We operate. We are there to defend the nation in the most extraordinary circumstances. And if that means putting your life on the line, that means putting your life on the line. I'll never forget at Staff College, when I was attending in 1995, the Chief of the General Staff came and said, there is one thing, only one thing, that distinguishes us from every other job in the world. What is it? And there were lots of sort of answers that were wrong. And then one person stood up and said, we're prepared to put our life on the line for our country. Said, yeah, it's the only thing that changes. It's the only thing that's different to every other organisation in the world. We are prepared to die for our country. And that brings with it so much of what we do. And we must never forget that we're here for an operational reason. And everything else should be subordinate to that. If you take that as our primary purpose, of course it's possible that people will think, well, that is the only thing. The danger, which I think you're alluding to, is that that becomes the only way of doing things. And of course, yes, people fall into that trap, particularly people who are very successful on operations. I remember saying to Chief of the Defence Staff, who was worried about the culture in the army, there was a particular Major General who was particularly toxic, but he was also particularly good in operations. And I remember saying to CDS at the time, I said, until you sack that individual for his toxicity, you will never change the culture of the army. Because actually, he represents the very worst of somebody who cannot change his style, despite the fact that he's a major general. He cannot change his style, and so orders his civil servants, orders his staff around as if they were on a battlefield, despite the fact he hasn't seen a battlefield for 5 years. He was quietly told to move on and he wasn't going to go any further. And unless he changed his behaviour completely, he couldn't. One of the things I'm proud of was I set up the first late entry course. I insisted that it was at Sandhurst so that every single officer in the British Army had a commonality, which is they'd all been to Sandhurst. So they weren't second-rate officers because they hadn't been to Sandhurst. Everyone went to Sandhurst. I was doing this as a major, and the general turned around to me and said, oh, well, so are you teaching them how to use their knife, fork and spoon? And I said, no, exactly the opposite. I'm teaching them what distinguishes me as an officer from private blogs. And the answer is that actually I have a wider vision of what we're trying to do in the army, what the army's about, what the regiment's about, or whatever level you are at. So the whole of that course was designed to be not how to use your knife, fork and spoon, but very much designed to be, this is the wider army, this is wider defence. As an officer, you need to understand that and you need to be able to use that to your advantage for your people, but also you need to be able to interact with it. And that's what that course was about. And I was really pleased because people came off that course expecting it to be a knife, fork and spoon course. You know, this is how you behave in the officer's mess, which is just, you know, so belittling. And say, no, actually, this is about, you're now part of a much bigger organisation of the officer corps. I learned so much from late entry officers and from my sergeant majors and from people much more junior than that. I learned quite often how not to do things from some of the officers. What it gave me was a sense of proportion about leading. And I never forget that actually a private soldier who makes lieutenant colonel has been through more promotions than somebody who goes from second lieutenant to lieutenant general.
You mentioned a moment of pride. Do you have other moments of pride, or do you reflect on things that you are proud of?
Yes. One of them is I designed a thing called Career Structure 2000 for the Army, which was the officer corps career structure, which lasted from 2000 till, well, I think they're still using it broadly. They're changing it now, so 20-something years. The whole idea of that was to try and allow people to be the best they could be, allow people to find what they were good at and then pursue it. There was too much of a view that you had to be the only thing you could be as an operator and good on operations. The vast majority of the army at officer level spend only a limited amount of time on operations. And from colonel onwards, it's rare to be on operations, frankly. I was incredibly lucky. So actually what you're defining is somebody who, if you want them to be really good at stuff, don't just pigeonhole them into one space because it becomes very difficult. One thing I did was bring in the Long Service Good Conduct Medal for officers. I'm proud of that. There was some dissent, a lot of dissent, that officers didn't deserve or shouldn't have to be recognised for it. So I asked the Duke of Edinburgh, actually, and I said, Prince Philip, sir, there's some disquiet about people wearing this medal. What do you think? I must have still been a very arrogant second lieutenant. This was the Major General. And he turned around and said, well, if the Queen sanctioned this, and if it's good enough for the Queen, it's good enough for me. And I will wear it with pride. But the other thing was, being in charge of the Honours Committee, a Royal Marine captain came with an MC, and he'd already had an MC, and he was put forward for a mention in dispatches. He had basically been commanding a Peshmerga brigade up in Mosul, was effectively the brigade commander, and had done some fantastic stuff, and he was on his MA, being recommended for an MID. And he was independent as well. And I turned around and said, that doesn't look right. So we graded him as an MID, and he came out exceptionally well. So I said, well, I'd like him to be graded as a DSO, please. And he came out exceptionally well for a DSO as well. So he was awarded a DSO. For me, this was two things. One, it was I had the courage to do that because my grandfather had come out of the First World War as a captain with a DSO and an MC. But the second was we had got into a rut that the only people winning DSOs, despite leadership, and DSO is about leadership, it's not about bravery, it's about leadership in battle. Despite that, the only people who seemed to be winning DSOs were lieutenant colonels. And yet I had a precedent 100 years earlier, which was people were coming out of the First World War with DSOs as captains. And so I wanted to break that mold to say, no, there are people who have really done fantastic leadership at junior levels. They should be awarded the DSO just like a private soldier can be awarded or a major general can be awarded a VC. These are universal awards in the sense that anybody should be able to earn them if they do the right thing. It doesn't matter about rank. So I was really keen to do that. And actually, one of the things that gives me most pleasure is my MA military assistant out in Kabul now has a DSO and an MC. That's the second person who's got a DSO and an MC. And I'm utterly delighted for him and his family because I know how much it meant to my father that his father had a DSO and an MC.
And remembering people's acts of bravery, amazing leadership and gallantry is part of what helps with generating and maintaining an esprit de corps and a fighting spirit. I know remembrance is really important to you. Can you give us a sense of why it's so important to you?
Yes, I think I would say it's the most important day of my year. In many respects, I think it's incredibly important because I think that it is too easy to forget the sacrifice that people make. And the sacrifice that people make is almost never for, quote, their country. It's for their mates. It's the ultimate in the sort of bond between somebody and their team. That is something which is incredibly powerful, that you're part of a team and that you're dying to protect your team. It's so central, so core to army values and my values, which is you're working for the team and it's every single member of that team rather than I'm doing it for myself. But there's other sides to it for me, which is there were three of us who were incredibly good friends at university. We all joined the army. We all joined the gunners. And within 1 year, one of them had been run over by an armoured personnel carrier and chopped in half and killed. And it is my chance to remember Bill every year, despite the fact that that was in 1987. It's a very, very personal piece about memories of people who I know died. I've been in that extraordinary position of both being in threat and ordering people into threat and into danger, and the tough decision that you take to say, actually, I remember once I rang my wife at 3:30 in the morning just before an attack we did in Iraq, saying, I've just ordered my soldiers to their certain death, which is what we thought it was. You have to understand what that means in really sort of visceral terms when you are taking young people and ordering them to do something that you know will kill them, or you've got a very, very high chance of killing them, and therefore, at the very least, remembering them. Now, in that particular circumstance in 2003, nobody died. We were incredibly lucky, but nobody died. But just remembering that is so important to me, and it sort of focuses a lot of what I do, I think.
I think for me, that recognition of the impact of being on operations was brought home very clearly when I was left behind. The battalion deployed at short notice to Iraq, and the commanding officer decided that I should stay and command the rear operations. The battalion had a challenging kinetic, as people call it, operation where there were a serious number of casualties and fatalities. And when we're on operations normally, we're completely isolated from all of that. And I had an absolute ignorance about what the experience was like for our loved ones left behind and then dealing with the consequences of fatalities and casualties. That was very instructive for me for my future opportunities to command and lead, because I then worked on the team that did all the repatriations between 2008 and 2010. And I know that you still have a keen commitment in the casualties space. Did that change how you led and commanded and thought, or had that already become part of how you led?
One of our soldiers was killed. He was an Irish soldier, and we had a memorial service for him at Armagh Cathedral while we were there. And we put a huge cordon around Armagh Cathedral. We were based in Armagh at the time. Because he was Irish and he was local, we did this memorial service, and I was the adjutant, and I was sat between the commanding officer and the RSM, and we were very tight in the pews. And sitting next to me was my grandfather. He'd been dead for 15 years by then. So my image was of my grandfather. And I remember him very distinctly saying to me, this is what being an officer's about. Soldiers get killed. You have to cope with that, and you have to move on. Absolutely, you need to do what you need to do on operations. And if that means people lose their lives, that means people lose their lives. You must minimize that as much as you possibly can. You must look after people as much as you possibly can. But you do what's right from the operational experience. And I think what I'd learned was it doesn't change the way you command in terms of getting the mission done, but it absolutely changes the way that you look after those who are the consequence of that.
You are a person with, I think, many passions, sustainability and climate change. You were probably an expert years before everyone recognised that you were. What drives you?
I think when I was younger, what drove me was a straight competition with my brothers. So I've got three older brothers, all of whom are utterly brilliant and have had extraordinarily successful careers. None of them in the military. I remember my first reporting officer when I was a brand new lieutenant, and he said, Richard, you're really competing, aren't you? And I said, yes. And he said, who are you competing against? I said, my brother. And he said, what regiment's he in? I said, no, he's not even in the army. And so there's an element of competition. I was competing to do the best I possibly could in a family environment. I think what came subsequently was my family had the most enormous sacrifices to put up with. 10 operational tours, children being brought up where, although they may not have recognised it when they were younger, my wife was constantly thinking, where am I going to live if he doesn't come back? What happens if he doesn't come back? You know, was making plans for if I didn't come back from particularly Northern Ireland and then Iraq. So the pressure on her, and to a certain extent the children, led me to sort of think, well, A, I want my children to be proud of what I've done, to recognise that I've done something, because I have taken an enormous toll on them by not being there a lot of the time. So it better be bloody well worth it. I think that's one part of it. But the other part with the sustainability, the week after I was promoted to 3-star, I had a friend who I used to meet every now and again, nothing to do with the military at all. We were meeting for coffee and he said, Richard, you've got a real problem. And I said, hang on a minute, I've just been promoted to 3-star. I've just got to the sort of top of my tree as the top of people, you know, in defence. I've got this enormous portfolio. And you say, I've got a problem. You know, what the hell's going on? And he turned around and said, you now know when you're going to leave the army. He said, with the best will in the world, you're not going to make 4-star. You probably know that. And he said, so you now know you're going to leave. And he said, you've been passionate about your soldiers and about defence since you were 16. What's going to get you out of bed in the morning when that day comes? And it's in 3 years' time. You can almost name the date. What are you going to do? That's your problem. And he said, go away and think about it. Think about what you're going to do. And then worked out what actually really does motivate me more than anything is leaving the environment I'm in better than I found it. So leaving the army in a place, or defence in a place where actually, and who knows whether I would have been successful or not, but leaving it in a place where actually people have more respect for soldiers. I was genuinely horrified as a very young officer at how poorly my soldiers were treated. And I really wanted to do something about that. Was I successful? I don't know, but I tried. When it came to outside the army, well, actually, how could I make the world a better place apart from something I genuinely believe in, which is climate change and sustainability? And so doing that, which was something else I'd long, long had a sort of a candle for, if you like, was something that I felt would motivate me to keep going. And it does. And it's depressing at times that we're not moving faster, and depressing at times that I'm not able to make more of a change as an individual. But I'm not going to give up trying.
You talked about the grounding effect of your motivation, which is peculiar, if I may make a generalisation, about senior leaders, particularly in the military. There seems to be an inverse correlation between the more senior you get, the less your feet are connected to the ground. Did you consciously work on that, keeping your feet on the ground? Did you have people who helped you with that?
I think I could have gone two ways. I think I could have been an incredibly arrogant, incredibly self-centred individual. And that's where having three brilliant brothers helped, and actually two brilliant parents as well helped. Yeah, I'm not that good. Goodness me. And I still think of myself as a fraud in the sense that, my grandfather fought through two world wars. I've done 10 operational tours. You know, that's pathetic compared to what he lived through. We lived for 6 weeks on the border in South Armagh in trenches, and we had to dig the trenches and then live for 6 weeks in them. I got one shower at Cross Maglen. It rained a lot, inevitably, and we had duck boards in the trench to stop ourselves getting trench foot. I did actually get a bit of trench foot because the boots were so awful. I wrote to my great aunt, my grandfather's sister, and said, I think I'm beginning to understand what my grandfather lived through. And she wrote back saying, you have no idea what it was like in the First World War. She'd been an ambulance driver in the First World War. I had people around me who were not in the army, who were grounding me all the time. I deliberately tried to say I don't know to a question from a subordinate at least once a day. If you say it too often, people will think you're just stupid. So you have to use it sparingly. But what does it do? What it did, to my mind, was it allowed somebody to explain what they did know. And if they don't know as well, then to have a conversation about what might be the answer. In other words, it allowed somebody into your world. I will never forget when I was adjutant out in Northern Ireland, my commanding officer, a guy called David Richards, who ended up as Chief of Defence Staff, was plucked away, despite the fact he was commanding his regiment, and told to write the plan for Northern Ireland as the brightest young SO1 in the province at the time. And he brought it back, and he and I discussed it. And we had a four-hour debate about the mission, just the two of us. And in the end, it got quite sort of, Colonel, you don't understand. And you know, Richard, don't be so stupid. I mean, we're incredibly good friends and I'm immensely respectful of him. And at the end of the day, after 4 hours, he said, Richard, I'm the commanding officer, you're the adjutant, we're going to do it my way, not yours. But he allowed me that space. He allowed me the space to argue with him, to debate, to put forward my views, which is immensely rewarding and confidence building. So I tried to do that. And that's what saying I don't know allows in a small way. The other thing that I sort of learned was senior officers should ask questions and not give answers as the opening gambit. If you ask a question, you allow somebody else to make a comment. If you give a statement, they'll say, yes, sir. And you never know whether that statement is valid or not. And they won't produce their best work. But if you ask them, say, how would you do this? Or why do you think that? It allows them to express themselves. And it allows you to understand that there's more to it than perhaps you haven't seen.
And I'm the beneficiary of that, because when I was working for you as both a one-star and a two-star, you created that space in your diary for me to come and talk to you about whatever you said to me I thought was important for you to hear and learn and understand. It made one feel valued, I suppose.
The first time I had a gatekeeper, if you like, to my office was as a commanding officer. The adjutant sat outside my office. It was an incredibly powerful position. Commanding officer is the most important person in the regiment. For somebody to come and see me requires a certain amount of courage to say, I want to see the commanding officer. And my view was, what right have I got ever to say no to that? Because I'll learn far more by somebody coming and talking to me. And they've summoned up the courage, particularly the more junior they are, they've summoned up the courage to see the commanding officer. What right have I to say no to that? I had two gatekeepers, effectively what they were saying, they obviously didn't say it in this language, effectively turning around and saying, you're not important enough to see the commanding officer. And in both cases, I very quickly moved them on and said, that's not your role. Your job is not to say no, your job is to find when. And that may mean a bit of time to wait, but it's to find when.
Finding when is a great tip for busy people to work out what is important, and undoubtedly made me want to go the extra mile for a great boss. Richard's passion, energy, and curiosity have defined his service. His willingness to say, I don't know, and not to answer his own questions ensures other voices are heard. We'd love to hear how you encourage safe spaces for people to feel valued. Send me an email at theculturekernel@bfbs.com or find me on LinkedIn. Take care until next time.